I also want to talk about the formation of IMBHs and globular clusters. And the results I'm going to present today, the new results, demonstrate the influence of initial mass aggregation. Now, this is work done by one of our new PhD students, Shangamitra Goswami. And And first of all, well, this is my standard introduction, but so far you already know what intermediate mass black holes are. So they usually occupy the region of mass between, 20, maybe 100 solar mass, up to 10 to the 4 solar mass, or even a bit more. Well, as you know, they've been predicted more than 30 years ago and thought to reside in the centers of globular clusters. And one hint is the extension of the N-sigma relation by Magorian or many other people down to the globular cluster regimes. And only recently, there's also some observational hints. We heard on the conference a lot about cusp density and velocity profiles. And Simon was talking about ultraluminous X-ray sources, so-called ULXs. Now, these ULXs, these are objects which exceed the flux of an accreting stellar mass black hole, accreting at the Eddington limit, which places its luminosity above 3 × 10⁻³⁹ Earths per second, or if you invoke some mild beaming, it's above 1 × 10⁻⁴ Earths per second. And these ULX sources are typically, these ULX are typically associated with supermassive black holes in the centers of galaxies. But some of these ULXs are clearly off-center. On average, 400 parsecs. This value comes actually from a review from Miller and Colbert in 2004. Now, since they are off-center and not directly in the center of the galaxies, these should be less massive black holes, which means not supermassive black holes, because dynamical friction is pretty efficient for these supermassive black holes and would bring them in to the center pretty quickly. They also, at least some of them are associated with young globular clusters, and one scenario they are generally thought to be mass transferring massive stars around intermediate mass black holes. And the scenario that might explain the formation of intermediate mass black holes and of ULXs might be the runaway formation scenario, although this has been investigated by many authors, Hopman et al. 2004, Blacker 2006, and Baumgart 2006, which is down here. There are many ifs to this scenario, but at least it is one way of explaining these sources and invoking IMBHs. Now, the runaway merger scenario, as Fred was already pointing out earlier this morning, goes roughly like this. You have dynamical friction, which brings massive stars to the center. This accelerates core collapse. You get this Spitzer instability. And massive stars have larger merger cross-section because of one thing is gravitational focusing, and the other thing is, of course, they have larger radii than low-mass main-sequence stars. And successive mergers then lead to a runaway growth. And now, in order for this to work, the core collapse must happen before the most massive stars turn into black holes. And for most massive stars, this time scale is approximately 3 mega-year. And the reason why this has to happen before this time is simply that once they turned into stellar mass black holes, these stellar mass black holes are a bit hard to merge, because in globular clusters, they have, lowish escape speeds of less than 100 kilometers per second, and these clusters of black holes would then quickly disperse, and you would eject all these stellar mass black holes mostly. And so now, in order to relate this criterion that the core collapse happens before 3 megayear to the cluster initial conditions. Atakan Gürkan in 2004 carried out an extensive parameter studying many globular clusters varying IMF, varying cluster concentration, radii, and so on and so on. And his main result is the following. Here a plot is shown showing the core collapse time normalized to the central relaxation time, the relaxation time of the core. This is for a single mass cluster, or a single component cluster, so each star has the same mass. And you see that this is the concentration of the cluster, it's W0. And you see that this depends on the globe, that the core collapse depends on the global structure of this cluster. Now, if you have a multi-mass cluster with a wide mass spectrum, the core collapse is very different from a single mass cluster. So, whereas in a single mass cluster, the core collapse is a global phenomenon, in a multi-mass cluster with a wide mass spectrum, core collapse is driven by mass segregation. So the most massive stars then, once they reach the center, then decouple completely from the system, forming their own subsystem with a much shorter relaxation time, and collapse on this much shorter relaxation time, and the core collapse time can be up to 2 orders of magnitude shorter than in the single mass case, or in the case where we have only a narrow mass spectrum. And in the multi-mass cluster, we have a clear separation of collapsing and expanding Lagrange radii. Lagrange radii simply denotes as the radius within which a certain fraction of the total mass is contained within. So in this case, you have a clear separation. So at some point, there's a subsystem condensing out of the cluster. In this case, the core gets gradually more depleted, and you cannot make this clear separation. So, and in order to find out what means narrow mass spectrum and wide mass spectrum, the IMF of the cluster was changed in many ways. Well, first of all, the single mass case, which are the points up here, where the maximum mass over the average mass is essentially one. So here you see the classic result that the core collapse time over the half mass relaxation time is around 10. Now, you can then take your favorite mass function, increase the maximum mass of the most massive star, and then you get successively shorter and shorter core collapse times. And the interesting result that came out here is that when the ratio of the massive, most massive stars over the average mass of the star is about is larger than 50, then the core collapse time seems to converge to one value, which happens to be at around 0.15 or 0.12 core relaxation times. So. Uh-huh. And another point to note is that this ratio for any reasonable IMF, this ratio is almost always above 50. So we are almost always in this regime where the core collapse time is like 0.15 core relaxation time. Now, and now we want to find out how this is related to the initial cluster structure that might lead to a runaway growth or a core collapse time which is shorter than 3 mega years. And this is shown here. This is a rather busy plot, and the solid line, which is the most important line, you should note, is the line where the core collapse time is exactly 0.15 core relaxation times at exactly 3 mega years. And here you see the n-body length in parsec, which is the very U radius of the cluster, and here's the total cluster mass. And these two lines are for W0 equals 3 cluster, and the upper line is for W0 equals 8. And there are many other details in here, but Mark Frieder carried out a simulation with including collisions and actually looked if this simple criterion we found here is actually valid, and the solid symbols here show cluster initial conditions that led actually to a runaway formation of an IMBH, and the open symbols are simulations where this where you didn't get a runaway. And as you can see here, this line is this criterion was pretty much fulfilled. So below this line you always find filled symbols, and above this line it's always empty symbols. So there's something somewhat more funny going on here. When you go to very large masses of 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 solar mass, but essentially the simple criterion was confirmed by Mark Freitag's Monte Carlo simulations. Same goes for...
Ask you the difference between triangles and...
The circles are for W0 equals 8, and the triangles are for W0 equals 3. Yeah. So, yeah. And also, when you look, for instance, for a million solar mass cluster, for W0 equals 3, you need a very compact initial condition. So it's like you need a cluster very radius of 0.3 parsec, while if you increase the concentration, you can still get into a runaway regime when you have a 2 parsec or a cluster size of 2 parsec.
So you want to point out, this is the follow-up on Mike's question. You know, currently, a superstar cluster, as measured today, would be sitting right up there, slightly above the upper line, right? So a few by 10^6, and a characteristic size of a few parsecs. So that's sort of there, a little bit to the left of that. So you can easily cross that line, you know, by saying, well, it's sufficiently concentrated, or the that characteristic size at t equals 0 was just a little bit smaller than what we measured today. Hmm. Or you can do crazy things. I mean, some of the simulations that Simon was talking about had a W0 of 11. Okay, that would actually push that line so far up that even with currently measured parameters, you might be in that regime of runaway growth. So it's not far, no matter how you look at it. It's all about what you think is, or the details of the initial structure of that cluster, really at t equals 0, as opposed to measured today.
I guess maybe I can make another point, or should we?
No, let's just go ahead.
So one of the reasons for the question is that for a star cluster, 3 million years is a very short time. So let me just say, I think it's a very interesting question, and that the whole notion that a black hole may form in a star cluster is a very intriguing one. So I encourage everyone to think about it and calculate. But I think there's a complicating factor that may not yet be in this and have a bearing on this question. I'm not sure how it'll change the answer, but I have a feeling it will change it at some level, and that is that 3 million years is so short. It's the same time scale that you would have to build the protocluster. It's the same time scale in which the stars form. A real cluster is going to be full of interstellar material. It's going to be losing interstellar material. nobody's ever seen a star cluster that young that didn't have a lot of interstellar material. And the young stars are evolving, and they have winds, and they're losing mass. And the mass loss is going to cause the core to expand rather than contract. So I'm just saying there are a lot of interesting things going on here. And I agree with you.
So I should probably stop you, but we actually had that discussion. That was the whole discussion this morning.
Okay.
It was all about, you know, is this reasonable at all? We do these simulations with no gas. We still assume, like in the old days, that all the stars are actually formed fully with the full
MF. Of course, the pre-main sequence tracks of these stars are getting on for that. So I think you have to walk before you run. So I don't want to sound too negative about this, but so this is obviously, in reality, a very messy, complicated problem. And to pretend otherwise, I think it's potentially oversimplifying the situation. So,
but nobody is pretending otherwise. You should realize this. I mean, we start. This is a clean problem. You can actually do the physics.
I agree.
And get a correct answer before you jump into the much more messy situation where you have gas, you have large non-spherical. You know, you might have several subclusters that are still in the process of infalling and merging.
They will speed things up.
They will
speed
things
up. The gas outflow will
slow
things down.
So there are things that help. Qualitatively, they're out of this mess. There will be things that help. There will be things that make this harder.
Right.
But you know, a lot of us thought, well, let's do the clean, well-posed calculation first, and that's the status now. I mean, there's still a lot of room for.
Okay. I should have come to call.
Yes.
Yeah. So the problem is, of course, much more complicated. At least in the n-body simulation by Holger, it's not yet here. This mass loss is accounted for. The mass loss of the massive stars to some degree accounted for, and he still finds under some certain conditions a runaway. So, yeah, of course, star formation is messy, and we don't know essentially how clusters actually build up over time over these first few mega years. But this is so much we can do about. Now, okay, Mark Freitag, Freitag et al. In 2006 also looked at the influence of collision on the core collapse time, and what's shown here is the is a measure of the collisionality of the cluster, which is the collision time at zero over the central core relaxation time at time zero. Collision time here simply means the time between collisions of the most massive star, which was in this simulation 120 solar mass, and the average a star with an average mass. Now, what's shown here is the onset of the runaway, and as you can see here, unless the collision time or this so defined collision time gets extremely short. We are essentially, the runaway essentially happens still at the core collapse time predicted by Gurkhan et al. In 2004. It's just when we start with extremely collisional clusters, the core collapse time happens even earlier. And the basic effect is that that collisions simply accelerate core collapse and thus the runaway by constantly dissipating orbital energy. And this leads to a shrinkage of all of the whole cluster. And and you can get an earlier runaway with lower, when you choose your initial condition sufficiently collisional. But as you can see, already the relaxation criterion already places quite severe constraints on the cluster radius. So if you want to have it even collisionally initially, you either have to go to very large masses, like 10 to the 7 solar masses, where you have to decrease the radii even further in order to get even more favorable conditions for runaways. Yep.
Can I ask a question? question John was saying this morning about, is it magic that sort of Monte Carlo simulations that don't include collisions and body simulations that do give you the same mass for the IMBH that forms? Like, maybe from this slide, are you implying that perhaps the separate component sort of already forms and then all collisions do is, after it forms, speed up the process or make it reach a higher final density or something? Like, I guess what I'm just saying is, this is not magic to you.
No, actually, from the results we find there's actually a dependence of the most massive star we form within these 3 mega years with the cluster initial conditions. So it doesn't always fall onto the Magrorian. Well, but I think the reason why it's difficult to explain. Also, the reason why difficult to explain the reason that N-body and Monte Carlo actually agree with each other, because N-body simulations are in a different regime where you get mass segregation just in the initial mass segregation, or well, the first phase of where the massive stars sink to the center. But then in N-body simulation you also form three-body binaries, which you do not form here at all. And then the whole collapse or the whole further evolution is driven by these tight binaries in N-body simulations. So we're really talking here about two different regimes. Here in this regime, where we're essentially above 500,000 and more stars, single collisions might dominate the picture instead of formation of triple binaries and then binary interactions.
But it really doesn't matter so much, right? I mean, part of the magic here is that once you have this exponential instability, it really doesn't matter much what the details are. So, for example, also with Mark Freitag, we had, you know, Mark for his PhD thesis had built this very elaborate database of hydro calculations of collisions that you could look up to know a bit better quantitatively what actually comes out of these collisions. This is much more sophisticated than the simple way that many, many people have used before, just doing sticky spheres and assuming that you just conserve momentum and mass in a collision. But it turns out, as Mark discovered to his dismay, that it really makes no difference for this. And again, it's because once you have this exponential growth that takes over, it really doesn't matter at all what the fine details of, you know, is it really binaries that mediate collisions, or is it single-single? What exactly are the details of how these collisions happen? Is the merger really mass-conserving or not? This is all washed out in the robustness of this instability.
So what I'm taking from what you're saying is that this exponential instability takes off after a subcomponent has already formed, and the formation of that subcomponent is sort of independent of whether of all of these details of whether
And also apparently independent of, even at low end, how you represent that. So even in the limit where formally the core, you know, might have in the n-body realization or in the real system a very small number of massive stars, you still get, you know, what sets that mass is still basically the physics of mass segregation, and it might fluctuate because of small numbers in a real system where small numbers of stars are in an n-body realization, but the physics is pretty robust.
But the mass of the black hole,
correctly. Black hole, be careful when you say black hole.
Very massive star. You know what he means.
Yeah. Okay. The mass of the most massive object. That 0.002, if I understand correctly what Stefan was saying, is that particular number is just the result of the particular initial conditions adopted in those simulations.
Right.
And the actual number is going to depend on the initial conditions. Do you have a sense of the range of initial conditions leading to that number? Is there some sort of plateau leading to that? Or it was just pure luck that they fit some initial conditions and they go...
Well, I actually find, well, this is now related to the runs done by Jangamitra with the initial mass segregation, and there the final mass of, or most massive star we obtain actually depends on the initial conditions. I think a degree of mass segregation. For some reason, we go from, but yeah, factors of two, 500 to
okay, so
maybe
1,000
or so.
Now the claims, hold on, to get into, is Holger here?
No.
Okay, but I'm being recorded, so I'll still be careful. Some of the people doing N-body simulations have claimed that you can get that coefficient to be a lot higher. I think you get that, they get that, in a very, very artificial way, by having initial conditions that are so extreme that basically collisions start right away at t equals zero. And then you sort of skip over this physics and what makes the whole problem robust. And of course, if you really start collisions at t equals zero, then as you expect, what you get what you put in. And you can get a lot more that way. I think it's very artificial, but it's been done, and it's been claimed that, that at least that way you can push that coefficient to be higher.
You're claiming that they put their initial conditions way down in this the corner of this diagram,
yeah.
Right? Very, very collisional systems.
Yeah, so... But if you don't rely on very specific initial conditions, you end up with an effect of
If it's the physics of the Spitzer instability that determines this mass, then it's very clean, it's very independent of the details of the structure of the cluster at t equals zero. It really depends just on the IMF.
Okay.
And it's quite robust, within a factor of two.
Okay.
Yeah,
and
I have another question. So, an interesting question here is how big a black hole could you grow? And that's of interest because, you know, there have been claims that people see black holes in globular clusters today, and maybe they started out this way. So the question is, do they keep on growing? And I suppose that this massive central object would keep on growing until some point it becomes very compact or it becomes a black hole. And I guess my question here, so you have statements like collisions accelerate core collapse and runaway. That must be up to the point at which the object actually becomes a black hole. And that's a question we'd like to know and have answered. So what do you have a condition and when do you decide that something has become a black hole rather than just a big fluffy thing that's there to capture more stars as they come to it?
We just have a very simple criterion and simply say, okay, we just observed the whole the most massive stars up to a time of 3 mega years, and that's it, and then assume that it turns into some at that time we stop our simulations. But what we are here interested in is not how massive this thing can actually get, because, well, it depends on the details of the stellar evolution and mass loss and many things we don't know. Here we are only, this is this time, for instance, here is only the onset of the runaway collision, of the runaway growth. We can't really make any predictions apart from the order of the total mass reservoir that might be available for the whole most massive star to grow.
Once it becomes supernova, then that presumably shuts down.
The first regular stellar supernova would just kill the whole thing.
Yeah,
and
so
this early dynamic stops the minute there is a single supernova.
Exactly. And so is that
But it already stops when the most massive stars grows up to about 1,000 solar mass, because then you get it acts like an intermediate mass black hole, like a sink of stars, and then you blow up the core, and then the collision time again increases, so you capture fewer stars, or simply run out of stars to feed the whole thing. So, and then at some point the supernova sets off, and then it's totally over.
But see, then we get back to this 3 million years again, because if stars formed over 3 million years...
Yes, rejuvenation.
Range, ...then you've already got, you know, some stars are already evolving off the main sequence and going supernova, while the others have just formed and are ready to participate in your core collapse.
Yeah, of course. This complicates the picture a little, but we know from N-body simulation that do actually take this into account, and also the rejuvenation of the most massive stars. So when you collide two massive stars, there's suddenly more hydrogen to burn, so they extend their lifetimes, possibly, if they return back to stars. But that's not really clear, since they're it depends on precise stellar evolution. And also in n-body simulations, some massive stars just turn to supernova and everything. But still, there are many details to this. But essentially, this simple criterion still gives you a good guideline on what to expect. So we're not claiming, okay, this is now our model of such and such, MGG 11 or something or so. We don't claim that. We just want to see when does this runaway occur. And things that you mentioned, since we stop at 3 mega years and the earliest stellar supernova is at 3 mega years, then I think this is, we got more or less robust result in that regard. So anything that happens after 3 mega years, we don't treat at all. Okay. Okay, now we, this is now the actual project. Well, we looked at the influence of initial mass aggregation, since when you look at young clusters, they're almost invariably already quite mass aggregated, to a degree that many people believe that mass aggregation must have been, you know, when the times were, when the stars were forming. So we see this frequently as the outcome of star formation simulations during the embedded phase. The keyword here is like competitive accretion, which is like accelerated dynamical evolution when the gas is still around. And then also, I mean, just by star formation feedback in dense gas clouds, which is from Murray, which was a paper from Murray and Lin. Whether or not this is entirely believable or not, I mean, there was a recent paper by Alves in, last year, who claims that all this mass aggregation we see in very young clusters might be due to statistical effects, and well, people haven't done their statistical analysis right, and so on. So there's quite some debate whether there is really initial mass or primordial mass aggregation or not. We were just interested in a different question, and that is, if the if clusters start out with initial mass aggregation, how would this influence our simple picture of the runaway formation of intermediate blast black hole, or would this extend the parameter space of initial conditions that might lead to a runaway collision? So, and the intuition was that you should accelerate core collapse when the massive stars are already further in. So, and in order to test this scenario, we took just two nice primordial mass segregation recipes out from the literature. Okay. The one is from Zhuber et al. There they simply place stars in different mass groups are sorted according to the mean interparticle potential and the degree of segregation one can adjust by choosing a parameter, so-called S, from 0 to 1. This mass segregation recipe changes the density profile. It starts from a Plummer sphere when it's unsegregated, and the further we increase the S parameter, the more it looks like a core collapsed globular cluster with a power log profile. This is also available as a software package and can be downloaded from Astro Uni Bonn. Now, this is another much simpler primordial mass segregation recipe is from Baumgart et al. In 2008. Here they simply sort stars of the in different mass groups according to the specific energy, and one could obtain a degree of mass segregation, or, well, if you completely, or if you sort all stars according to their specific energy, then this is what they call completely or fully mass segregated cluster. Now you could also do only partial sorting, and you could probably adjust the degree of mass segregation there. What we did was we mainly looked at the Joubert et al. Recipe for varying S parameters, and also had a quick look at the Baumgart recipe. And yeah, if we take if we generate our clusters using these mass segregation recipes, this is essentially the mass profile we get. So this is the average mass in solar mass over the radius of the cluster, and the dashed line here is for unsegregated clusters, and here you see the average mass profile for mass segregated clusters. Here is for S equals 0.1, so you see that in the inner part the average mass of the stars is increased by a factor of 2 roughly, and here for S equals 0.2 it's pretty significantly increased by almost a factor of 5. Now, this is the same for the Baumgart recipe for a fully mass-segregated cluster for two mass functions. Again, here you see almost a factor of, about a factor of 5 increase of the average mass in the inner part of the cluster. So,
what's the initial range of masses?
This is always from 0.1 to 120.
Under that point.
Yeah. Okay. Now, so this is the same plot. This is a different plot, but the same recipes. Okay. What's plotted here is the cumulative mass spectrum of two stellar mass groups. One is the massive stars above 20 solar mass, and these are the stars above 50 solar mass. And the different lines here, the innermost line is for an unsegregated cluster. And you can see here the median is around one. The median of the 50 solar, the stars with larger than 50 solar mass is around 1/2 mass radius, and this median shifts to smaller and smaller values as one would expect. And for S equals 0.2, it's one sees that the massive stars are further in by a factor of 4. Approximately, and the stars in the other mass bin are further in by a factor of 2. So, in principle, this is quite a significant effect, one can see here. This is the same for the Baumgart recipe. We get a similar factor for the same mass groups. So, based on that, one would already expect to see quite a substantial effect, since the stars start further in, so they should have an easier time to actually collide with each other in the center. And so these are basically our first results. We carried out these runaway simulations similar to Freitag and Gurkhan et al. Using 500,000 stars. We varied this S parameter from 0.2 to 0.3. So Peter from, 0.2 to 120 solar mass. And our collision recipe is just that of sticky spheres. And these are the results for an unsegregated Plummer model. The red line indicates, this is a similar plot like that of Freitag. So this is the virial radius of the cluster in parsec, and this is the number of stars, or the mass of the cluster for a given mass function. The red line indicates, again, this 3 mega-year limit. And below that line, we would simply expect to always get a runaway, which you can see here by these filled symbols. Above that, we wouldn't expect any runaways. That's why we have empty symbols. So our code works as one would predict, Now we increase the level of mass aggregation, and then we already extend this area a little bit. So for instance here for number of stars. Oh, okay, I should also mention it's not always 500,000 stars. We also have a 300,000 star run and a 1 million star run. So just neglected here. Here you see we can almost push the virial radius of the cluster up to 1 parsec. We also don't see a clear trend here, so we still have to do a bit more runs just to get good statistics and see whether this little strange bump, it's probably noise. But you already can see that we can push the limit almost up to a virial radius of 1 parsec, which is nice. This is the same for s equals 0.3, and here you see, well, we certainly extend the parameter space by a bit, but the effect is not very large.
Are you losing the dependence on the number of stars, or...?
This I actually don't know, but we still need more simulations just to assess. I mean, we should carry out more simulation using exactly the same initial conditions, but with different realization of the IMF, because especially, I mean, with a Salpeter IMF and also with a Krupa IMF, you don't have a lot of massive stars. So, and for the Monte Carlo method, to work reliably, you need a lot of massive stars. That
you might expect
contribute
qualitatively, right? Because you rely more and more on already having whatever number of stars the rest of the mass functions basically become less.
It makes sense. You don't need a small number of stars in order to have a quick collapse. So it makes sense if you're losing the dependence in there. It's consistent.
Okay. Now. What we plot here is the co-collapse time over the relaxation time. And so, since we want to find out what actually the reason is for the Juba et al. Recipe to lead to much shorter co-collapse time, and as we see here, that we still have to get some error bars on that, but the TCC over TRC value, this is the one predicted by Gürkan et al. And here our values kind of scatter around a bit, around this value. So this relation is not really changed, but what changes in the Juba recipe, since it changes the density profile, the core relaxation time itself just decreases. And this is essentially, so here's the TCC in mega years over the S value, and for various clusters with initial radius 0.4 up to 0.7. So this is for a 0.4 cluster. You see it decreases more or less monotonically with increasing S value, and this is mainly because of the mass density profile. Okay, and now we carried out similar simulations for the Baumgart et al. Recipe. Here we took a slightly different approach. Here we only measured the TCC over TRH value and compared it with the simulations by Gürkan et al. And this is without initial mass aggregation, and these points here are with initial mass aggregation. What we did here is simply we varied the maximum mass of the IMF and simply plotted this TCC over TRH value. As you can see, there's only a moderate decrease in core collapse time and only a moderate increase in parameter space available for runaway to occur.
So the TCC gets slightly shorter.
Yes,
but
slightly.
Going back to some of the other figures you showed, the radius of the cluster can increase by a factor of 5, and so you have a runaway, right? It's your slide pack.
Okay.
Well, you don't have to show it unless you don't want to, but basically we're looking at the parameter space based on, so number of stars and virial radius of cluster.
No, here we are looking at TCC for this maximum mass over average mass.
No, I understand.
So this is the other plot by Gürkan et al.
I understand. But yeah. You're saying that with mass segregation, you get a minor difference here.
Yes.
Right. Very but minor. If you translate that into the size of the cluster, that gives a runaway. It's a factor of 5 difference in the size of the cluster.
Not necessarily.
Yeah, okay, why don't you go back to that?
I know.
Well, that's a 0.3.
Which plot do you mean?
Keep going.
That was the other.
This one.
That was the other implementation.
Too far. No, you went too far. It's
okay.
Forward 1, 2, 3. Keep going. It's the open circle.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you go two more.
Okay.
One more. Yeah.
There you go.
See, if you look, I mean, the allowed radius of the cluster is a factor of 5 bigger, unless I missed something.
Yeah. Well, that's factor of 5. Okay, this is.
That seems appreciable. I mean.
Okay, when we compare this, is 0.3, and 0.5 is. Well. 5 is a bit large, but
okay, so
it's a factor of, well, I would conservatively say 2 or so.
Okay.
2 to 3. I mean, it is not overwhelming.
Okay.
That is to say.
I guess that was a little optimistic.
Yeah, well, if you. Okay, of course, these radii are already small, and then. Yeah, well, okay. You get a slight increase.
Well, it's an important regime, because if people are
sure
that everything's at 3 parsecs, we're getting closer and closer.
Yeah, we are getting closer and closer, but this already at s equals 0.3, this is extremely mass segregated, actually. So, and I don't know if you can actually, you would have to look at a young cluster and see at the level of mass segregation. It's already had. Yeah. That's actually all it. My summary. Okay. Yeah, so this is also my summary. So the influence of mass segregation is a moderate increase of range of virial radii that allowed for a runaway merger. Well, depends on how you define moderate. Largest difference is for a Joubert et al. Recipe, which because it changes the density profile and therefore decreases the central relaxation time dramatically. And yeah. And the Bongard recipe, which does not change the density profile, I should say, and the core collapse time decreased by about 30%. And yeah, we're still speculating about the reasons, yeah.
Okay, so that's what so you used two different recipes, but you didn't apply, you didn't use that phase space plot. We're looking at when collisions, when runways happened and when they didn't happen.
What do you mean?
So the open circle, filled circle plot?
Yeah.
You only used the super recipe.
Yes.
Right. You didn't try the Bongard one for that.
No. Okay. But I can easily calculate that as well and just draw a line.
Yes, the recipe is less important than the actual degree of initial mass segregation.
Well, no, they're very different recipes. One from change, yeah.
I mean, my point is that I would expect the recipe to be less important than the actual degree of initial mass segregation. So if you get more or less the same mean mass radial profile in the end, I don't know, but I do not think the actual recipe that you use make much difference.
But the two recipes don't give you the same mean.
Let me tell you why this is.
They actually do to some degree. If you can adjust in the Joubert recipe, s equals 0.2 or 0.3, it's actually, it gives us pretty much the same profile as the Baumgart recipe.
So we got knobs to, but
make a comment on this, that in principle, you know, you could push this a lot. So I think it was, who was it, maybe Steve McMillan showed results where the initial mass segregation was basically implemented by actually letting some real dynamical mass segregation happen, and then you just redefine t equals zero.
Yeah, that's what we did. Yeah.
Well, you could have a prescription for initial mass segregation, which basically says evolve these clusters up to an instant before the onset of runaway, and I redefine that to be t equals zero. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you would have shrunk that time to core collapse to zero. So this is, of course, absurd. But what it tells you is that you know, within these various prescriptions that may or may not make sense, you know, there's a corner of the parameter space where you can, in principle, make this time shrink to zero if you really wanted to. So I think all it says in the end is that, you know, in the absence of better observational constraints on what this effect really is, and how much of it is really present, just by playing with theoretical prescriptions, you.
Yeah, no, my point was that, as Stefan was saying, as 0.3, the S0.3 parameter must correspond to some other parameter in the Bonker recipe, and you get more or less the same mean as radio profile, and in the end, I must say, if you do it dynamically, as we did in the paper, it's almost impossible to get the same level of extreme level mass aggregation that you get with these recipes. These really give you something that two-body relaxation or dynamical is not going to give you. So, but of course, it can be star formation producing.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't have to do it dynamically as well.
This Eicosanet and Schubert recipe is actually derived from actually watching gamma sphere collapse. And
so it might be okay.
Yeah, but that's not how you got your mass aggregation. Yours was very violent.
Sorry?
Yours wasn't any relaxation process that you got your mass aggregation from.
In our case, we just, it was a way of navigation. It was dynamic, like it was two-body relaxation.
Oh, I thought it was, this is not the thing where you smack two clusters together.
Sorry?
Where you're smacking two clusters together, the subclusters.
But that's a way to preserve
initial
mass aggregation if clumps are preserved. If clumps are initial aggregates, yes.
That's,
okay, we're looking at a slightly different.
Yeah. We've heard about the dynamics, now let's look at this from the stellar evolution point of view. So this is work that I've done in collaboration with Yevgeny Gaburov, Selman, Mink, Onopols, and Simon as well. Right. So the main question here is, does a merger run that I'm going to try to address here, does a merger runaway lead to the formation of an intermediate mass black hole? Mm-hmm. Now we've taken collision sequence for the as input for stellar evolution. We used the ones that Simon also showed in one of his plots. So there are merger sequences that came out of N-body simulation done with StarMap in the StarLab in the context of the cluster MGG11. In particular, this is some 10, 20 collisions within the first 3 million years. Which actually means that the time between collisions is normally longer than the relaxation time for this object, which is about 10 to the 4 years. So the merger product has time to settle into thermal equilibrium before the next collision happens, most of the time. That means we can actually simplify the treatment of the hydrodynamics a bit. So there's a make-me code called Make Me a Massive Star that approximates the hydrodynamics of the collision of two massive stars in a similar way to Jamie Lombardi's Make Me a Star code does for low-mass stars. It's essentially an entropy sorting algorithm, and it's written by Evgeny Gaburov, and Jamie is also on that paper. And it turns out we did a couple of collisions in the sequence with Make Me a Massive Star, and actually it turns out, and I'll show in a couple of slides why that is, that you can pretty much approximate the collision products by just taking the two stars, mixing them homogeneously, and throwing away some mass. So we do keep the mass loss from the collision that's predicted by making a massive star. I should mention, actually, that the mass loss prescription used by making a massive star is calibrated for collisions between massive main sequence stars, which have a slightly different, or can have a radically different structure from the type of object that you get out of these runaway collisions. On the other hand, you get a mass loss from the collision between 1 and 10% or so. So it's not, you're not losing large chunks of mass in this way.
I didn't understand this. The mass loss prescription is from the SPH coverage.
The mass loss prescription that's in Make Me a Massive Star is calibrated to SPA's calculations of collisions between massive main sequence stars.
That's the right way to do it. You made it sound like
I'm not colliding massive main sequence stars. I start with a main sequence star and slam a main sequence star in it, it's a collision product, and then I keep slamming main sequence stars into it.
Oh, I understand. So, okay, so your mass loss prescription is always refers to unperturbed main sequence stars.
Yes.
Okay, fine, sure.
When you have this perturbed, it's not polytropic. Well, how strong it deviates if you speak about the polytropic and if you apply polytropic prescription, which I believe will be in the Make Me a Massive Star.
No. Make Me a Massive Star is based on SPH calculations.
No, I understand, but if it uses a massive star, which is a polytropic at some level, and so when you have a collision product of that, it also can be somehow considered as a polytrop, maybe of different index or whatever. I don't know how strong it deviates. Well, it's obviously a bit...
Quite a bit if you have a composition gradient. Mm. If you have a composition gradient, your star is no longer a polytrop. Mm.
Well, not for the envelope. I mean, envelope is... You have a composition gradient in the core, but your envelope should be sort of... described by the polytropic prescription. It's radiative. It's simple family of the same entity.
Actually, since we're asking questions, I had a question about the very first slide where you mentioned that you're starting taking a set of 10 or 20 collisions within 3 million years from a dynamical simulation. And then the time between collisions, you said, is longer than the thermal time scale. But
on average.
Okay. Yeah. I'm wondering the following. How much of this statement results from the fact that in the dynamical simulation, the radii of these stars are taken to be those of thermal equilibrium stars? So I'm wondering... if you considered stars that get more and more puffed up with every collision, would you end up with more frequent collisions that actually bring you into a situation where the time between collisions is shorter than the thermal relaxation?
Well, out of thermal equilibrium, you go down almost exponentially. Mm-hmm. So basically, you're very much out of the thermal equilibrium, but it's pretty short time. So you're still out of the thermal equilibrium, I don't know, like how many years after, but you're like 10% only.
But not that much.
Okay.
Well, in the case that you're describing, basically, you go to the work that Jamie did, where he's doing one collision after the other. It's the other limit. So Jamie, he's doing SPS calculations where he's colliding two stars, and then he keeps saying...
Keep hitting the thing without giving it time to relax. And in this case, you do have time for relaxing. Of course, you're right, this thing is larger, and actually... The detailed calculation of the evolution of the collision product gives a larger radius in some sense. We'll probably get back to that. Than what was assumed in the embody calculation. So in that sense, you've decoupled the dynamics from the evolution and the hydrodynamics, which means you're not doing everything self-consistently. On the other hand, from the point of view of the star that's being hit, It just sees an incoming star every now and then. So you might change the details, but from the point of view of the star that's receiving the incoming stars, it's pretty much a stochastic process when it's going to be hit again and what the mass of the next collider will be. So I don't think it will make a difference to the actual evolution or the outcome of the evolution for the collision product. Mm. You could simplify the hydrodynamics by just taking two stars and mixing them completely and throw away some of the mass. And since the time between collisions is typically long compared to the thermal timescale, we just construct equilibrium models as well. We don't follow the initial contraction, except in a few models that we calculated with make me a massive star. It doesn't really make any difference.
Maybe a comment. This is valid for low-end systems. When we have really large clusters with many stars, Mark Freider could show that actually this collision time scale is shorter or of the order of the thermal time scale. So there we are in a different regime.
Yeah. I'm not convinced that that actually matters for what comes out of this. So one of the things I spent a lot of time thinking about before starting the calculations is stellar winds. Basically for a couple of reasons. Fred is smiling.
I completely disagree with your first bullet there. Why would that be? Sorry.
Well, I had a reason for putting that in.
Okay, why don't you say it?
If you want to form a black hole by keeping these, slamming these things together, at some stage in between, I mean, these things you throw in are they're stars made of hydrogen, helium, large quantities of hydrogen mostly. If in the end you want to end up with a black hole, it has to go through some sort of stellar core collapse.
Going back 30 or 40 years, Martin Rees was writing papers about primordial gas clouds collapsing monolithically to form massive black holes.
Without igniting?
Absolutely no reason why this thing ever has to become any kind of star again.
If you take 1,000 solar masses and you collapse it, it's going to ignite hydrogen, and that's going to halt the collapse.
How do you know that?
I can show you calculations of stellar with a stellar evolution code that does stable hydrogen burning.
You've gone around full circle now. I don't know. It depends what this thing is.
No, it doesn't.
It's not obvious to me.
Not at all. Once you reach temperatures and densities that are high enough to ignite hydrogen, you ignite hydrogen and you halt the collapse.
Well, it's the same as people never believe, like, in the past, electron capture supernova, because we'll say, well, you have oxygen burning. But you don't realize that there are some other processes which actually emit some neutrino, which carries away much more energy than you get through your burning. So when you say about that you ignite hydrogen, you're just extrapolating from the regime which you know of the stars which in completely different mass range.
But the local thermodynamic conditions, temperature and density, that's what determines your hydrogen burning conditions. Yeah, so you know what the conditions there are.
That part is reason. If you look at the old literature on what people used to call supermassive stars, yes, under if you assume you start with hydrogen, which of course I don't know here, that's what you're doing. But there is a minimum mass below which nuclear burning will actually stop the collapse. I forgot what that minimum mass is. I think it's around 10 to the.
I know what you're referring to. It's something like Kato or something. It's huge.
4 yeah. to 10 to 5 solar masses, so it may be a big higher masses than what we're talking
it
about.
It is.
This is under very lots of simplifying assumptions going to calculating this thing. And if you have a gas cloud that is rotating, differentially rotating, doing all kinds of things that are hard to predict here, and it's not a hydrogen cloud, I mean.
It's mostly hydrogen.
Well, you said also about a lot of helium production, so at some point your cloud actually will be very
heavy. Sure. At which point you can do helium burning.
It would not necessarily come into hydrogen equilibrium. You may just go right through that. So it would
just have a
ball. It's not an issue of just burning hydrogen or not. It's whether it actually ever slows down enough to become hydrostatic equilibrium, or you call it.
At some point, you have a ball of radiation supported material.
Yeah.
That's very unstable. It should collapse if it's massive enough. That's the whole literature on supermassive. But anyway, at least now I understand the point you're making, that certainly you can understand it better if it goes through the usual stellar evolution processes and forms a core that we know at some level and understand it has to collapse. Okay.
And I think certainly for these masses that we're talking about, it's 1,000 solar masses. This is going to happen. So it's at some stage it's going to look like a star. In fact, it's going to look like a very massive star. And we know that the evolution of very massive stars is pretty much determined by their mass loss rates. So we need to give some thought to what sort of mass loss rates we're going to use. And for very massive, very luminous stars, they're pretty uncertain. So to give you the punchline where this is going in the end, now, this is the growth of the merger product from the M-body simulation. This is one of the lines that was also in Simon's plot. This is the result of the detailed calculation with stellar evolution. So in the beginning, you don't grow to the same level, but you grow up to a certain point, then you sort of sit there around 400 solar masses. You increase a bit at the collisions, then you go down again from mass loss and stellar winds. And then at some point, your star, at this point actually, your star becomes a Wolf-Rayet star. You kick in a Wolf-Rayet mass loss rate, and your star basically evaporates. You kick it up again a couple of times, but in the end, you're going to end up, it ends up with as a 13 solar mass object.
And each red circle is another collision?
Each red circle is a collision, yeah.
So again, this is in this very, very extreme regime where collisions almost start instantly from the initial collision. Have you shifted all this so that the initial rise were starting at 2.7 mega year, right? You would then grow to, even under these assumptions, 400 solar masses, right? And then that would be the end of the story.
It's already Wolf-Rayet stars.
If you're only doing the collision here, I mean, you're already going and pushing it into a Wolf-Rayet star. You'd probably end up with something like this, only at this stage.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to do it, but I think you should do it because this is interesting and it will be very different. I mean, first, the stars that collide at 2.7 mega year, they're very different stars because they've evolved. They're about, And the other thing is that soon after reaching that first peak of growth, you'll have your first supernova and the whole collision business stops. And then you really have to ask yourself that 400 or whatever it is, solar mass object, do you just leave it alone? And now you have to ask yourself, what kind of remnant does that leave?
Well, we can do that.
Do you still reach 400 solar masses?
I don't know, you have to do it.
Yeah.
Let me say how long it takes to calculate from here to here, which is about an hour, hour and a half maybe. So it's certainly doable. Yeah, give me a list of masses and a list and times at which to collide them, and I can do it.
If you wait for so long, though, from the most massive, you will have significant mass loss already. So then you will affect on the main sequence, and you will be reaching for the most massive stars to be off the main sequence. So have mass loss from the core. I mean, it will change the dynamics. It's not clear to me that you just translate this to the right and it's the same thing.
No, it's different. That's why it's interesting.
Yeah.
But you have to do both the dynamics because your density is changing.
You have to redo the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I just clarify one point? So when you reach like 400 solar masses, if you leave it alone, no more collisions, it will also become 13 solar masses in your prescription? Because I'm trying to understand. So the collision here, they create the final mass or they increase the final mass or they just do nothing after you reach
Actually, the mass you have here is about the mass you thought you were going to end up with when you were here.
So if you reach the 400 solar masses and no more collisions, what will be your final product in your evolutionary prescription? Because, for example, Simon in the previous sessions, he just told, okay, we will balance whatever, like 200 solar masses or whatever. So it seems that your winds are even stronger than his winds.
No.
Well, you must have that alpha or whatever.
No.
Also. well, you must have something.
So to come down to such low mass.
So 400 solar masses from a stellar mass black hole, which is normally comes from what mass?
400?
Well, who knows? No. But like 400 solar masses, in whatever normally is taken in population synthesis in depths.
For what metallicity? For solar?
That's a low metallicity. Actually, it should be low metallicity than solar. But
well, this is solar actually, because Simon's calculations were also for solar metallicity. I did a similar calculation where I just lowered the metallicity for all the stars. It makes a bit of a difference. Your mass loss rates are about a factor of 10 lower.
Just my understanding that stellar mass black hole is up to 20 solar masses. So the stellar mass black hole should come from normal stellar mass, but 400 solar masses is above the normal stellar mass. So it should somehow produce something a bit bigger than the normal stellar mass black hole.
You don't know that. That depends on the mass loss rate.
You have normal 400 solar mass stars. I mean, in normal population synthesis, we don't produce these kinds of stars.
Why don't we let him say what he's actually done before?
this is retroactively checking or verifying or justifying the high mixing the entire star. Mm-hmm. This is a Kippenham diagram of enclosed mass coordinates centered surface and H, and then the shaded region here are the convection zones. This is the outer mass boundary, this is nuclear burning. Pretty much over the entire range, this thing is 90% convective by mass.
What stellar mass is this?
It starts at 92 and then it's...
So you have what we call 400 solar masses helium core, right? So at the end of your sort of... you have 400 solar masses helium core.
It's hydrogen and helium. It's still hydrogen burning.
Well, the whole star is
all convective and it's burning in the center. So you have to end up with...
At this point, your star becomes a Wolf-Rayet star. And you kick in a Wolf-Rayet mass loss, right?
So it's a 400 solar mass helium star.
It's not a helium star. It's a hydrogen burning star. It's a core hydrogen burning star.
Can you explain the diagram first?
I'm sorry, but then it's not a Wolf-Rayet star.
Hold on.
That depends on how you define Wolf-Rayet star.
Explain the diagram, please.
What
is the line, the solid line?
So the solid line is the total mass of the star as a function of time.
How can it go out?
Collisions.
Oh, this is already...
This is the same history we just do it in the red circles.
Okay, so I just look at that initial 90 solar mass star, or whatever, and you're saying it just almost all of it is convective.
Yes.
And it jumped from 90 to 220 in one collision.
There were no collisions.
It's a couple of collisions here. So here, actually, the first collisions are.
And you didn't lose anything, or you lost some, or you.
You do lose some.
And we believe that Jamie says that these things are actually going to be able to stay together, given that these things are, as Fred says, very radiation dominated, unstable.
He includes radiation pressure in his SVH.
Jamie's, and they still do hold together in collisions like this. Okay.
Yeah, that's because they're quite centrally concentrated and actually hard to, even though the total binding energy is nearly zero.
It's actually not that easy to expel the envelope from
that. That binding energy is all down there where the mass is.
Yeah.
And
yeah. It doesn't.
So it looks like this arrays between the addition of mass from the collisions and the loss of mass from the winds. And so the obvious question is, how are you doing the mass loss? Okay. What's the physics there?
From the wind. I'm coming to that.
Yeah, because that's
if we let him.
If we ever let him finish. let's go back to Natasha's point.
Yeah.
Is the convection zone going from, pick something up in the, well, any of them, but somewhere where it's around 400 solar masses. Mm-hmm. Pick a model, any model. Okay. The outer few percent is not convective, and then we have a convection zone. Does that go all the way down to the core?
Yes. Mm-hmm. This goes all the way down.
So this region is burning, so the hydrogen burning products are being mixed, not to the surface, but close.
Up to here. Due to mass loss, you actually strip up to a point where you were mixing it to before.
Right. So you're getting a helium-enhanced wind. By that point, you're getting a helium-enhanced wind coming off the surface of the star.
So these really are N equals 3 polytropes. They're basically constant entropy objects. They're basically constant entropy objects, is what you're saying. And so that's how you get this nearly complete mixing, because there's nothing is...
That's right.
This is why.
And actually, if you look at models for these massive stars by Jungelsohn, that Simon also mentioned, and I calculated a couple as well, they also show this. So it's consistent with models of normal, quote-unquote, supermassive star evolution.
And Jungelsohn is using Eggleton's code?
Yes.
And you're using Eggleton's
code? Yes. Okay. Different version of Eggleton's code.
Have you compared to Alex Heger's models, who does also, has looked at supermassive stars and what they do?
No.
Incidentally, again, from the old literature on supermassive stars, even without doing any kind of stellar evolution, I think it's well known that these objects are convective. Tend to be fully convective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is they should be
convective even if they were simply contracting without any nuclear burning going on.
So, just briefly discuss the top panel, which is almost the same as the bottom panel, except it has radius instead of mass on the vertical axis. And this sort of comes back to the question, how big are these things? Now this bit here is this bit here. So this entire region above, well, actually from here up to the dash dotted line, up to the edge of the star, that's this black line in the bottom diagram.
The dash line is?
That's 99.999% of the mass or something like that. So are these things big? Well, if you look where the photosphere is, yeah, they're pretty big. If you look where most of the mass actually is, well, not that big.
And that's what matters for the collisions, where most of the mass is.
Oh, probably. I mean, you have this dense core, and then you have this tenuous halo, and you have a star that flies through the halo. What happens?
So going back to the question that was asked previously, where would the radius of what the N-body simulation assumed?
That's somewhere around this dash dot.
So the N-body simulation knew nothing about this fluffy stuff on top anyway. So
no. So it's probably sort of okay.
I have done some simulations of collisions with extreme, well, not that puffy, but really puffy stars. And the answer is you can fire pretty much anything through the envelope.
Yeah.
Nothing happens.
What you might do is you expel that fluffy bit out there. Well, it doesn't have any mass anyway, so the star just expands.
Yeah,
so, evolution track and leading up to stellar winds. You start here with a 90 solar mass star, and you hit it by collisions, and you just push it somewhere up there, way above this line, the Humphreys-Davidson limit, which Simon also showed in one of his plots. It's roughly where your luminosity approaches the Eddington luminosity. You get somewhere right up there at the top. That's where the Wolf-Rietz mass loss winds kick in. And it goes down here, does a little red supergiant loop, and this is pretty much what a normal Wolf-Rietz star evolution track would look like from that point onward. So, mass loss rates. This is mass loss rates from the literature. As I said, this is mostly by Dutch people. Nubius is not Dutch, but Henny Lammers is. There's an empirical rate for luminous stars by the Jager et al., which is convenient because it covers a large chunk in the HR diagram. Of course, it's not based on anything in this region. I mean, we may have some stars here, some stars at the other end, and they extrapolate in between. So whether it's at all realistic in this range, probably not. But it has a nice property of giving you a large mass loss rate during the red supergiant phase and pushing you back away from that. Then there's mass loss rates for O and B stars, the Vink et al. Mass loss rates, which are line-driven winds, which cover a nice range in temperature. They don't really go up to the luminosity that we need.
But mostly from O and B main sequence stars, right?
Yes. And there's the Nugis and Lammers rate, which is Wolf-Rayet stars, which can apply roughly around this range of temperatures, and they're determined for this range of luminosities. But you, of course, can only apply that if your star, by some criterion, is a Wolf-Rayet star. And the criterion many people use to determine whether it's a Wolf-Rayet star is to look at the surface helium content. So it's not saying whether the star is core hydrogen burning or core helium burning. There's nothing in the observational definition of what a Wolf-Rayet star is that says whether it should be core hydrogen burning or core helium burning. So you just define it from the surface properties. Okay, well, that's very nice. None of these really cover what we need for the evolution track, so we need to extrapolate somehow. Oh yeah, there's another mass loss rate by Krudrytsky that people doing collisions between massive stars have sometimes used. We didn't use that because he's not Dutch. Well, actually, we didn't use it because it doesn't quite have such a nice temperature range. And if you extrapolate this to higher luminosities, it's pretty much the same as that one. So, anyway, we need to extrapolate. You should never extrapolate mass loss rates in effective temperature, because the effective temperature is what determines opacities at the stellar surface and the line driving mechanism. So we want a mass loss rate that covers roughly the right range of temperatures, which is goes back to why we prefer to think rate. You need to extrapolate to higher luminosity into what would be the luminous blue variable regime. If you apply a line-driven mass loss rate in this regime, it's going to be an underestimate for the mass loss rate that the star would actually have if you applied an LBV-type mass loss rate. We don't really know what the mass loss rates are, but if we apply a line-driven mass loss rate, we can reasonably be sure that it's a lower limit to what the actual mass loss rate should be. So we try to be conservative.
Why is that? I mean, why are you saying that?
It's because these mass loss recipes are typically a power law with some power of the luminosity. And as you get closer to the luminosity, to the Eddington luminosity, this power law index actually increases. We're keeping it constant. And the physics behind it is that, well, we don't know that much about LBV mass loss, but if you believe the model of Stanowoki, it's a transition from having a stellar wind that's driven on a few spectral lines to a stellar wind that's driven on a continuum of an optically thick layer. So the mechanism is different.
But that's a static atmosphere, isn't it? I mean, what? assuming that there's no turbulence in the atmosphere?
I'm not making any explicit assumptions on that. I just use Maslow's rates that are available in the literature for stars in this temperature range. So this is sort of what we ended up using. Remember the previous plot, this is a little bit different. So we have the Vink rate, which is defined somewhere up to here, which we extrapolate somewhere up to there, along this half of the track. And then we have the Wolf-Rayet rates across this part of the track, and we only apply the Agar rate at this point.
So, do you have any Maslow's estimates for pistol current ether carina, and which will be in agreement with your extrapolation? Because ether carina, I know about the explosion, eruptions, etc., which has nothing to do with the normal mass.
These guys have higher Maslow's rates than what I'm using here.
But those are because of a possible binarity?
Maybe? Because they're LBVs. Or they're in the LBV regime.
They think that all the explosions and so on are from the binary region. Pistol star, I don't know. I think it's... Is it thought to be a binary?
I think it's... I don't know of anyone saying that it's a binary. Mm. Which probably means it's not known. So, yeah. These are conservative estimates for the wind, for the mass loss from stellar winds, and you end up pretty much blowing off any material that you accrete onto this merger runaway pretty efficiently. Anything you're going to include, higher mass loss above when you approach the Eddington limit, higher mass loss due to rapid rotation, which we didn't take into account, that's all going to increase your mass loss rate.
So the LBV type mass loss presumably does depend a lot on assuming that these become stars again. But the wind-driven mass loss, I would think, does not.
No, that just needs a photosphere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So is it in that sense that you said it doesn't make that much of a difference in the end if we have enough time to return to thermal equilibrium or not?
Yeah. So, okay, that's pretty much what I wanted to say about winds. If someone wants to shout or ask questions about that, feel free. I just wanted to put up a quick slide about some of the nucleosynthesis that we got out of it, and abundances, which would be really interesting, because if there's some sort of signature, abundance signature that comes out of this, that you could detect, you could look at the cluster and say, oh, I see this abundance pattern. Well, maybe, if you have a model that you believe, that's an indication that the collision runaway happened in this cluster at some point.
What kind of abundances are being assumed in your winds?
It's basically the surface abundances. So the abundances...
It's going to be changing dramatically as you go along, presumably?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
So that gets
The abundances from the wind here is just integrate surface abundance times m dot dt.
And the wind loss formulas take into account the change in the abundances at the surface?
Yes
because
and no.
If they're derived assuming mainly hydrogen, that's presumably going to become less valid as you go along.
The OMB star winds are driven on metal lines.
Right. Okay, so that doesn't matter.
Mainly iron lines. And you can do it with carbon oxygen lines as well, but it's mainly iron group elements. That's not going to change. When you switch to a Wolf-Rayet type mass loss prescription, that usually includes an explicit dependence on the surface helium abundance.
Okay.
So that's then taken into account by the recipe. So looking at the amount of mass, total amount of mass that you use, lose. If you just have the single stars that went into the collision, they would have lost about 648 total masses in stellar winds.
So that's the total mass that the 20 stars that you merged would have lost if they had not.
Yeah, if you allowed them to evolve on their own. This doesn't include supernova yields, by the way, because I don't have the supernova for the merger sequence. So ejecta from the collision, about 230 solar masses, much smaller than about 700 solar masses that you lose in the wind during the time that the merger sequence is ongoing. And after the merger sequence has ended, and you continue the evolution of the merged object until carbon ignition, you still lose about 100 solar masses, which is, of course, going to be extremely helium-rich because, well, you've pretty much mixed this entire thing completely for 3 million years. So in total, you end up losing about 1,000 solar masses, which is more than you would have lost from your population of single stars. And it's pretty helium-rich. It's somewhat oxygen-poor. Nitrogen-rich.
Which makes me want to ask about sodium.
I'd love to be able to tell you about sodium. Unfortunately, this is Peter Eggleton's evolution code, which is means that this is basically what you get for nucleosynthesis. There's two extra elements, actually, just neon 20/22. And it's magnesium 24, but
you should be able to do something with magnesium.
Yeah, I should be able to do some post-processing. Actually, I talked to Corinne Chavanel this morning, and you probably would see a signature in the sodium. You probably would see sodium enhancement from this as well, just based on core temperature. But you would not see a change in magnesium isotopes, which is what she finds from her rapidly rotating star models that produce the abundance anomaly. So on the surface, this produces an abundance pattern that's very similar to what you would get from normal massive stars. But there might be some differences that we can pinpoint. That's something that's that has to be done, basically the nucleosynthesis for this. And that was the last slide.
Okay. Last half hour.
Anyone still awake?
Any other questions, or shall we just?
Well, just one. So, are you claiming then that an intermediate black hole, mass black hole, would not form, or is that the bottom line?
Well, that's. I mean,
fade away too fast.
But now that there must be, looking at your diagram.
I mean, that's pretty much the inescapable conclusion to draw from this diagram.
But for that particular cluster with that particular collision ring, but isn't there, it looks to me like, couldn't we design a cluster specially that had a collision rate that was high enough to overcome your wind rate?
Well.
And then it wouldn't turn off. Right, in other words, that.
Well, that may try it and send me the data. I'll happily run the models. But what I.
There must be a collision rate rapid enough to compensate for that.
Well, exactly. The problem is that your massless rate increases superlinearly with the mass of the star at some point.
If you go back to the Mark Freitag papers, he claims, although I don't remember the references, he found some of the largest mass loss, wind mass loss rates in the literature, and applied them post-processing to his simulations. And for his collision rates, he actually still grew to something to 1,000 solar masses or something. But that's, I don't know the exact time scales, but it's obviously much steeper growth in the mass than the Zambyi simulation.
So, in principle, you can keep pushing stars there to compensate for.
So let's turn the question around. Assuming you can do that, is that cluster realistic?
Okay, no.
Or is
that was, yes, I was not asking.
Really. That's really what I'm asking is instead of just saying it's either, because it's not so simple, it's just it's either possible or it's not. It must mean that there's some critical growth rate that you have to exceed for your story not to be true. And then the question is there any real cluster that's in that regime or not?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, people were already complaining that Simon's calculations were, or Simon's models were very dense and very mass, well, I mean, not mass area, but very, at a very dense
very score. Very concentrated, yeah.
And there's one other question, actually, that's, that occurred to me, is that do you have enough ingredients in your code that if this star had wanted to go supernovae somewhere along the line, it could have?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say after 1.5 Meg, I mean, do you know for a fact that your star has not gone supernova all the way to the end of your calculation?
Why would it go supernova? Mm. It's doing stable hydrogen burning in the core. Mm.
Okay, so you're sure of that all the way through?
Yes.
Okay, well then that's...
You don't exhaust hydrogen until somewhere around here.
Okay. All right. So you have a critical ray. The question is, are there any star clusters that have that ray or more?
So this is solar metallicity. I read it. So we actually calculated a couple of merger sequences. They all pretty much look the same. So I'm just showing this one. I recalculated one of them at lower metallicity, 0.001. Mm-hmm. And there you would maybe end up with 100 solar masses at carbon ignition. So presumably, well, if that goes into core collapse, the star goes into core collapse, that might give you a 100 solar mass black hole. But it's also in the regime for apparent stability supernova. So I'm sort of guessing it's probably going to turn out to be apparent stability supernova. So again, no really massive black hole. But for that, you would need to follow
the growth.
Sorry?
That's still for the results from the M-S.
Yes. Yeah. That's still from Siemens merging sequences.
So what metallicity would the winds be so weak that this wouldn't be important?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer...
Or 100?
Well...
For solar? Like, I'm just thinking about, you know, a lot of globular clusters have metallicities of 100 for solar. How much of this would be relevant to that? Or what about a population 3?
Well, we're not talking population 3 stars here.
I mean, that's, what about 100?
Although even for population 3 stars, I think the picture's not entirely clear. But if you find that for... You go to low metallicity, and you do find runaway growth, and you do find the black hole, that a black hole of... few hundred solar masses forms. What you've shown is that with conservative estimates for the massless rate that are too low, you can do it. So to say anything about whether you can do it or not at low metallicity, you really need to understand massless rates at lower metallicity as part of the diagram.
That comes from function metallicity.
It's for line-driven winds about square root of metallicity or something like that.
Oh, it's only square root?
Yeah, square root or z to the 0.7 or something like that.
So some of this may not actually happen at globular cluster metallicities. Your rays would be slower by factors of 30 or so.
Maybe. My lower estimate would be smaller by a factor.
Good enough?